countries.
Essentially, what these people are able to do is to hack into any system. Most of the cyber traffic that goes through the world goes through Tel Aviv, go through Beersheba now, and the reality is that they could technically access any system. That means that, you know, Britain or America or any global powers, nuclear, firing mechanisms and their systems and their codes could all be hacked by these Israeli Mossad agents. So this is hugely concerning, the fact that they can do this. And then the fact that there is no international body really capable of managing or controlling them. There's no oversight. There's no ethics or morality laws internationally which are in place to be able to control this. And as with anything else, technology tends to come first, and the questions of safety, security, ethics, and morality come later. And that's deliberately done. It's done with the connivance of America and the money mafias that run most of the affair there, because they basically are the prime beneficiaries of greater surveillance, of greater access to all information all around the world. And so that's why you see a lack of inertia within international bodies like the United Nations or any other particular body dealing with security and safety of the world.
According to the Home Ministry of Bangladesh, the government has taken the initiative to introduce an integrated lawful interception system to monitor social media and thwart various anti-state and anti-government activities. The government claims to be using it for lawful purposes. However, the ground reports also from some other countries have given a different picture. Nearly all the countries that signed the Abraham Accords were given the Israeli spying system. There's a nexus between the Ministry of Defense and Foreign Affairs of the Zionist regime to sell these spywares in return of getting recognition from different countries. Israel has been offering surveillance assistance to countries for supporting its illegal accreditation. It has been using this spyware diplomacy to even secure votes of some countries in the UN. The sale of this spyware program has also helped Israel to secure a seat in the African Union for 20 years.
Israel has already got a very intricate network of lobby groups, the groups like IPAC in America, and even the Friends of Israel in Britain. They're just two examples of their huge network of lobbyists. These lobby groups have huge money. They're financed and powered by all sorts of folk, perhaps the Rothschilds, the Rockefellers, and even others. I mean, there's just too many to name. So they get private financing, and they also get state funding from Israel. Israel, of course, gets $4 or $5 billion on the surface from the Americans annually for all these activities it gets up to. But they have a lot more money privately. It's basically limitless. Now, what they do with these lobby groups is they burrow into the political systems of other nations, and gradually the influence becomes more and more powerful, and they buy off people. They have the money to do that. They spy on them, and they'll find information. They might find all sorts of secrets or, you know, immoral things that perhaps sort of politicians have done, corrupt things that they've done, and then they'll use those facts in order to blackmail those politicians around the world. They'll in privately threaten them with exposure if they don't do what they say.
The cyber weapons, being more deadly than the conventional arms, are destroying the peace of the countries, therefore affecting their population. Bangladesh seems to be missing all these important points and thus falling in the hands of the Zionist regime to be used as a pawn for its exploitative policies.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
6 years ago, on November 8, 2016, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi appeared on national television informing that all 500 and 1,000 rupee notes will turn invalid by midnight. The move, known as demonetization, was shocking for the country's population, who were forced to form serpentine queues in front of banks to exchange the currency notes. Three main economic objectives of demonetization were listed by the Indian government. They were fighting black money, fake notes, and creating a cashless economy by pushing digital transactions. But it seems that even after 6 years, demonetization has not achieved its targets.
The Indian government claimed that the aim of demonetization was to try to make India a tax-compliant society. Tax compliance leads to higher revenues and lower budget deficits. The money collected as taxes is spent on infrastructure, the social sector, and national development. The Modi government claimed the move will benefit India's poor. But according to a study by the Reserve Bank of India, the introduction of the GST resulted in higher operation costs for small and medium-sized firms and the informal sector, which also includes farm workers and mom-and-pop store owners. A very large part of the informal sector depends on cash transactions for sustenance. The plan of demonetization sucked out a very large amount of cash from the economy, severely impacting everyone in the informal sector as the business got disrupted and the entire supply chain derailed. According to the Indian Goods and Services Tax estimates, about 12 million people immediately got affected by the note ban. Replacement notes also didn't help much, as 3.3 million people permanently lost their livelihoods. From agriculture to constructions to automobiles, the Demonetization Act led to the collapse of several legitimate businesses.
2016 was not the first time when demonetization took place in India. In the year 1946 and 1948, similar measures of banning various currency notes were taken. However, the Reserve Bank of India never supported the measure. Not paying any heed to the apprehensions stated by the Reserve Bank of India, the government went ahead and legislated the withdrawal of legal tender status using its powers under the Union List of the Constitution of India relating to currency, coinage and legal tender. According to statistics provided by the Reserve Bank of India, the Demonetization Act sucked out 86% of the currency in circulation, thus affecting the livelihood of around 482 million people who depended on cash incomes.
At the beginning of 2023, India's Supreme Court upheld the legality of 2016 demonetization move, saying the individual interest must yield to the larger public interest. The reality about public benefiting from the move seems the opposite. Since demonetization, more than 500,000 companies have been shut down and at least 1.5 million people have been rendered jobless. The employment rate fell from 42.59% to 41.45%. The unemployment rate also declined from 7.51% in 2016 to 2017 to 4.66% in 2017 to 2018 because of the shrinking employed force. According to a 2018 report from the Reserve Bank of India, 15.3 trillion rupees of the 15.41 trillion rupees in demonetized banknotes, or approximately 99.3%, were deposited in banks, leading analysts to state that the effort had failed to remove black money from the economy, which happened to be one of the most important aims of demonetization. Fake notes or counterfeit currency notes were to be targeted through demonetization. But according to the RBI data, counterfeit notes continue to be circulated even now. Another major aim of demonetization was creating a cashless economy mostly used by well-to-do people. Digital channels could have been picked up even without this highly disruptive economic move. According to experts, during the first quarter of demonetization, the growth rate of economic activity was lowered by at least 2%, and except in certain areas such as more formalization of the financial system, demonetization has failed to meet its stated goals.
Now to talk more on this, we are joined by Mr. Leo Saldana, an analyst from Bangalore. Welcome to the program, Mr. Saldana. Now, as a result of demonetization in India, more than 500,000 companies were shut down and at least 1.5 million jobs lost. So the question is, what has India gained from this move?
See, recently the Supreme Court went into the question of whether demonetization was actually a legal move. Of course, the majority judgment went in favor of the government, saying that the government was within its rights to do it. But the dissenting opinion of Justice Nagaratna is extraordinary because it actually highlights how it was not only illegal, but totally unnecessary. And that, in a sense, echoes the widespread view held across the country that demonetization was a method in madness. It was the most undemocratic a call ever made by any government in post-independent India. We have had reasons to demonetize before, but it was never done as recklessly as it was done now. It was almost done in a way to say that, you know, one man knows better than the rest of the country. And it has had disastrous consequences. The numbers you speak of is largely a conservative estimate. We really don't know how many businesses have been affected. Small and medium enterprise as a sector got wiped out. The trading sector got wiped out. The farming sector got emasculated, I must say, because almost all farming trade that happens is cash trade. And millions of farmers were reduced to poverty. In fact, more recent numbers are coming out. And the government of India has done an extraordinary disservice to the people by blocking any effort to do any surveys. We have something called the National Sample Survey Organization, which periodically does surveys. Their surveys have not come out. Any effort by, I mean, we don't even have a planning commission anymore. We have a propaganda machinery called the Niti Aayog, which basically talks what the Prime Minister wants to be said. So it's a totalitarian system. And as a result, the truth is not possible to assess objectively. What we have is a lot of work that independent economists have done, and it shows the horrific consequences of demonetization. It has, in fact, taken India back by decades.
So, Mr. Saldana, economic experts had repeatedly warned about the consequences of demonetization, and we saw how it affected the common man. So why is the Indian government still adamant and doesn't accept that demonetization was a mistake?
Well, you see, it's the nature of the government. It's a government which does not believe in democracy. Right from the first major policy decision of Prime Minister Modi, which was to promote the complete so-called reform of environmental laws, which was in 2014. He set up a committee for that, and he gave them 3 months to rewrite the environmental laws of India, which we have built over 4 decades. And they did a ash of a job in 3 months, and we had to resist against those moves. But that was indicative of the type of policy changes that were likely to come. For instance, take the goods and services tax, which was meant to be about fair sharing of resources between the states or provinces and the union government, because India is a union of states. We are not a central government-led parliamentary democracy. We are a union of states which governs the country. But that, of course, was forgotten with the goods and services tax, where the way in which it was implemented on the back of demonetization destroyed trading sector, because the GST system collapsed. Contracts were awarded to favorite companies like Infosys, which obviously couldn't do a good job. And then, as if that was not enough, the income tax system was also handed over to Infosys again. And even the income tax collection system collapsed because the softwares didn't work for quite a while, almost 2 years. And then we had the problem of the pandemic when nothing really happened. So we have had a series of crises which have been created by the government quite unnecessarily. There were systems which were working fine, which had been built over decades. But here is a man who wants to say he constructed the country, and no one before him has ever done anything. So when you have a man who comes with such a narrative, which is ludicrous, then what do you expect? There's no argument against such a statement, you know. Like you've seen totalitarian regimes across the world.
Now, Mr. Saldana, recently the dissenting minority judgment of the Indian Supreme Court has regurgitated the issue of the autonomy of the Reserve Bank of India. So, is the Reserve Bank of India sufficiently autonomous?
Well, you see, we have a long tradition of the Reserve Bank of India being very, very staunchly autonomous. Like, you know, we have had such great economists like Dr. Manmohan Singh, for instance, and so on. I mean, he became the Prime Minister of India for two terms. When they led the bank, even though there were attempts to influence them, they could forestall such influence. Now, that's not the case under Narendra Modi. You bring, if somebody does not listen to you, he's removed. If somebody has a different point of view, he's removed. So the independence of RBI has been heavily compromised. And that we have seen in the way in which the income tax laws, in which the GST was promoted, in which demonetization itself happened. And if the dissenting judgment is at all any indicator of the widespread view held, it in fact speaks for all of India. Most people, most states agree that the demonetization was the most atrocious act of undemocratic decision-making ever in the history of free India. And so it's unfortunate that the majority did not agree with that. Majority judgment did not agree. But if you look at it, forget the numbers, but if you look at the arguments made, Justice Nagaratna's argument is splendid. It goes into every detail of what was the purpose of creating the Reserve Bank of India as an autonomous institute and what is the basis on which demonetization has to take place. You absolutely need the approval of the RBI. In this case, it was absolutely not taken. It was not possible to take. He just rushed it through. He thought of it one night and next morning it happened.
Last but not least, creating a cashless economy was pitched as another major target of demonetization. Now, couldn't digitization be achieved without a highly disruptive economic move?
Look, anyone who knows the reality of India will realize one thing, that, you know, much as you have one of the largest cell phone bases amongst consumers in the country, the capacity to use the cell phone to transfer to digital economy is almost non-existent. I mean, I live in Bangalore. Even I don't have the capacity to use many of the UPI-based, I mean, despite the fact that I'm educated, I'm quite adept with software and so on. It takes quite a bit of learning to get used to that, you know. Now, UPI-based transactions are there everywhere now. You can see street vendors to everyone else doing it. But the point is this. Much of the rural India does not have internet connection. Even though there is a claim that we have penetrated far-flung areas with electricity and therefore internet is likely, you actually step where I live and I have to stand outside my home to make sure I get a fairly good internet connection. This is a reality in Bangalore. If you go another 20 kilometers outside of Bangalore, internet is almost negligible or non-existent. So in that kind of an internet darkness, none of these digital economy systems will work. Now, let's presume that in future we are going to spread internet and make sure everybody has an access to internet. Then comes the challenge of the technical capabilities of people. Softwares keep changing, apps keep developing, all sorts of viral threats are there, hacks are there, attacks on the software are there. And then who has the capability of constantly updating their phones? Because we have seen just in the last 5 years, phones keep getting updated. There is built-in redundancy as well. This is not affordable to the local people, which is why in the 70s, when we nationalized our banks, we made sure our banks were accessible to the last person in the most remotest village of this country.
Well, there you have it. Thank you, Mr. Leo Saldana, for being on the program. He's an analyst from Bangalore. Now let's see how people have reacted on social media.
A patriot only said, "Bad days are here again. We have jobless growth, 81 CR pours, and no government sector employment hope for youths. Depression is systematic creation of demonetization and disinvestment of public sector. Depression is future of India, a self-created demon." Lal Bahadur Vivekanandaran tweeted, "4 years back, I told my daughter to go away from India. 2016 demonetization day, I very much started to fear future of Indian businesses. Just witnessing wherever I am touring, the most spending people are non-resident Indians. Selective sector is spending and gradually this will create unrest." Prabhakaran posted, "Useless. India never forgets BJP's blunder mistakes like Gujarat riots, demonetization, immediate lockdown, hate speech against other religions, and many more."
And that was our episode about the India demonetization and the effect of this plan on the social economy after 6 years. And also the surveillance software deal worth millions of dollars between the Israeli regime and the government of Bangladesh. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take great care.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked in
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum to you dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Mandegari. Stay tuned.
تواضع یعنی کوچکی کردن در برابر یک بزرگ. پس ما بزرگتر از خدا کسی نداریم.
Humbleness means to show courtesy before a great entity, which according to Islam is Allah. But in Islam, we are recommended to show humbleness before the creatures of Allah too. Why? Because they are created by Allah, who is the absolute source of greatness. Sometimes we see some people who respect the son of a great man. Why? Because he is the son of a great man. Here we find that all the great men on earth are the creatures of Allah. Thus, we must show our absolute humbleness before Allah.
کوچیکی میکنیم. بله، سه تا تفاوت رو قرآن گفته.
We lower ourselves before Allah and His creatures. However, we must show more respect for three types of people according to Islam and the Quran. Those three are the people who are knowledgeable, those who are God-wary, and finally those who struggle in the path of Allah. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Mandegari. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye. Thank you.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Syrian officials and human rights organizations blasted the catastrophic impact of Western sanctions on the Arab country, saying the restrictive measures have hampered the government's ability to meet the basic needs of the Syrian people. They censured the U.S. and EU for imposing cruel sanctions and taking other illegal coercive measures against this country, stressing that Western sanctions amounted to economic terrorism and have had a disastrous effect on the day-to-day life of Syrians. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Syrian Arab news agency Sana'a reports the Syrian Foreign Ministry condemned the United States for targeting its health sector with unilateral sanctions, calling for urgent international action and saying that the fresh, inhumane measures fall within the context of Washington's cruel and unethical blockade against the Syrian nation. In a statement, the ministry said the sanctions imposed by the U.S. Bureau of Industry and Security, BIS, hinder Syria's import of medical equipment and spare parts for a large number of public and private hospitals. The foreign ministry noted that the targeted hospitals, including the General Authority for Children's Hospital in the capital, Damascus, provide healthcare to millions of Syrians. It dismissed Washington's false claims that medicine and medical supplies were exempt from the illegal sanctions, as no party is exempt from the unilateral coercive measures. It called for urgent action from the United Nations, the World Health Organization, and the International Committee of the Red Cross, ICRC, to put an end to such sanctions. Syria has been in the throes of foreign-backed militancy since March 2011, While the Daesh terrorist group was vanquished by the Syrian government, the Takfiri terrorist groups continue to hold sway in some parts of the country under the patronage of Western powers. Numerous reports have pointed to the U.S. role in transferring Daesh terrorists to the war-ravaged country and even airlifting supplies to the group. The U.S. government has imposed sweeping economic sanctions against Syria amid the Arab nations' uphill battle for reconstruction and recovery. The controversial Khazar Syrian Civilian Protection Act, signed into law by former U.S. President Donald Trump, targeted individuals and businesses that participated either directly or indirectly in Syria's economy. The restrictive measures have blocked imports of essential goods, affecting the Syrian people's access to medical equipment, food, heating, gas, and electricity. Meanwhile, the TASS news agency writes Russia's UN envoy says the West is liable for the deteriorating humanitarian situation in Syria, as Western sanctions have impeded the stabilization efforts in the crisis-stricken country. Speaking at a UN Security Council meeting, Vasily Nebzenia argued that sanctions are a significant factor in the degradation of the humanitarian situation in Syria. Nebzinia said Western delegations detail their so-called efforts to deliver humanitarian assistance to Syria, but close their eyes to another uncomfortable topic, their criminal unilateral sanctions, which are biting ordinary Syrians. He said, as a matter of fact, Western countries are deliberately worsening the crisis in a bid to contain the process of normalization of the situation in the country, and discredits the actions of its legitimate government. The Russian diplomat noted that the West is purposely creating artificial barriers for the return of Syrian refugees from neighboring countries for fears that the Syrian government would receive political dividends in case of the mass return of Syrians. He said, "We believe that such dirty political games on Syria must be stopped. This is the will of the Syrian nation as well." He said, "We want humanitarian aid to be delivered to all Syrians without double standards and discrimination. We want it to be done honestly without any politicization and parallel unilateral measures, as such practices undermine the viability of any humanitarian assistance." The United Nations Food Agency has warned that around 4 million Syrians risk hunger and poverty in the war-ravaged Arab country. The UN's World Food Programme, WFP, sounded the alarm in a post on its Twitter account recently, saying, "Without urgent help, 4 million more could slip further into hunger and poverty." Back in May, WFP said a record 10 million people are now food insecure in Syria, which has endured almost a decade of foreign-backed militancy and is under rounds of crippling economic sanctions imposed by the U.S. Damascus has blamed Western sanctions for its struggling economy. Moreover, Press TV's website reports the new Syrian ambassador to Russia, Bashar al-Jafari, has lambasted U.S.-led sanctions against his country, saying the bans amount to economic terrorism and have catastrophic impacts on Syria's human rights situation. Jafari said recently the coercive economic measures by the U.S. target Syrian people's livelihood and the right to life and welfare and health. Jafari also said the terrorist war against Syria, foreign occupation for its territory, and the external support for terrorism have caused catastrophic impacts on the human rights situation in Syria. The senior Syrian diplomat said in a statement the U.S. Western coercive economic measures have also escalated the catastrophic impacts which targeted the Syrian citizens' livelihood and his right in life and welfare. He added that the Western coercive measures have turned into economic terrorism, targeting the Syrian citizens in their right to life, health, education and development in all of its forms. The senior Syrian diplomat charged Britain, France, the Israeli regime and the U.S. of violating international law by occupying parts of his country, saying the foreign occupation in support of terrorist groups has limited the state's ability to take up its role as the guardian of citizens' human rights. Jafari also charged U.S. occupation forces with destroying oil and gas infrastructure in the Euphrates region, saying the Syrian government is facilitating aid deliveries while facing a systematic terrorist war. He said Syria facilitates the access of humanitarian assistance to all its areas without discrimination, including hard-to-reach or besieged areas by terrorist groups. Also, an Iranian envoy to the United Nations has called for an immediate end to Western countries' unilateral sanctions against Syria and their looting of the Arab countries' resources in a bid to supposedly help improve the humanitarian situation there. Speaking at the UN Security Council session recently, Zahra Ershadi, deputy permanent representative of Iran to the UN, said the Syrian people have been suffering from one of the biggest humanitarian problems in the world for more than 11 years. She added the international community has a serious political and moral responsibility to deal with this dire situation. Ershadi underlined the need to implement Security Council Resolution 2585 in 2021, which urges all UN member states to respond with practical steps to address the urgent needs of Syrian people in light of the profound socioeconomic and humanitarian impact of the foreign-backed war and terrorism.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to Islamic Upbringing. This is your host, Zainab. And in this program, we try to answer your questions, queries, and issues you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. The answers are based upon Noble Quran and the narrations from Prophet Muhammad. May peace be upon him and his purified family. Today in our studio, we have with us our guest speaker, Professor Salman Naqavi, who is a faculty member at Al-Mustafa University, Qom. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome, sir.
Thank you very much. It's an honor.
Well, Professor Naqavi, since we have been talking about the issues related to adolescence, now we have one of the audience questions over here, which reads that, what is the way to behave with an adolescent who thinks that his life is good for nothing and stays away from the gatherings?
So this goes back to his understanding of his life. We need to develop a comprehensive understanding that he has come here for this in this world with a purpose in life. He has to achieve a goal. There's a destiny for mankind. We're not as other animals are. We're not just here for to eat and to make merry, to enjoy our lives. It's a continuous struggle. It's a continuous journey towards excellence, towards perfection. We are here. We have started our journey in this world from a point where we do not know anything. Allah Almighty says that we have created you from the wombs of your mothers, and you have brought you forth in this world and in a state that you do not know anything. لَا تَعْلَمُونَ شَيْئًا. But the purpose of your creation is مَا خَلَقْتُ الْجَنَّةِ وَالْإِنْسِ إِلَّا لِيَعْبُدُونَ. We have not created the jinn and mankind other than for our worship. And worshipping is being obedient to him, to follow his commands. And that leads us to perfection. That is based on our knowledge and understanding. So the more we become knowledgeable, the more we excel and we reach out to Allah Almighty. Ya ayyuhal insan innaka kadihun ila rabbika kadhan famulaqi. Oh man, you are in a constant stage of struggle and striving towards to reach out to Allah Almighty,
yeah,
and you shall meet him. So this is a journey which starts from zero and it goes up to infinity, because Allah Almighty is infinite. So
yeah,
our journey towards Allah is infinite. So these concepts have to be brought home to a child. We, of course, ourselves should be able to realize them, understand them, comprehend them, and then we have to bring it out in our, not only in our the way we talk and what we talk and how we communicate with our child, rather we should become examples of a person who is continuously, perpetually engaged in that struggle. And that makes life meaningful. The struggle is not for just being able to eat and to drink and to clothe ourselves and to have a good home and to have a car. This is not what life should be about.
Okay.
Unfortunately, if that if we are living a life which is towards for material gains, only for material gains, we're not condemning material gains at all, but we are just saying material gains and rewards are for the sake of achieving excellence spiritually.
Yeah.
But if the gains of material gains become an end in themselves, instead of being a means to an end, then life becomes a vicious cycle. And when we are engaged in such a way of living, which is, in the opinion of the Holy Quran, a life of animals rather worse, then our child will also feel that he has to be engaged in such a struggle. And he may feel let down if he is not able to achieve that.
Yeah.
And then he would prefer to go back into himself and become an introvert and feel everything is for nothing.
All right. We'll discuss more on this important topic after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned with us.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I'm Zainab with Professor Nika V, and we are talking about an adolescent who thinks that his life is good for nothing. Professor Nika V, you refer to a very important concept that if an adolescent sees the life around him, which is without change, which is constantly going to the materialistic purposes, that's how he actually sees life is going nowhere. And he feels like his life is good for nothing. So is it the environment that the parents create at home which makes him feel like that?
Of course, as a child, as we believe, every child comes to this world with the nature, the nature Allah Almighty has created, the fitra, which is based upon Islam and Tawheed. Every human being created in this world, kullu mawludin yuladu ala al-fitra. And there's a hadith which says, every human child which comes to this world is naturally his instinct, by instinct, by nature, by the fitra that Allah has created in him, he is a godly person. He's looking for perfection. He's looking for something which is beyond this material world, is something which cannot be achieved in by the material, by gaining material gains. It's not through that. It's much beyond that. There's something which is beyond this material world. It is something which is beyond what we see apparently. Every human being, every child has this feeling, this understanding within him. He is looking for something which is perfection. But when he sees the society, his even his relatives, his family members, continuously struggling to make things happen materially. Everything has to be for this. The success story is material gains. There's nothing spiritual about it. Then he feels confused because the natural
fitra
wants him to, is seeking for something else.
Yeah.
And the world is taking him towards something opposite to it. Again, we need to understand spirituality is not the condemning the world. It's not
ignoring
the world. It's not a life of hermitage. We've mentioned this before. La ruhbaniyata fil Islam. The basic concept is that whatever we do in this material world, whatever we strive for, is actually for the sake of akhirah, for the sake of developing our abode in the hereafter. Everything which is done, every single action which we carry out in this world, will have its effect
consequences.
And consequences in the hereafter. So everything, even if we're trying to make money, even if we're struggling to carry out work which is necessary for making an earning, because in Islam it is important for especially the man to work and to earn a living and to manage his household and to provide them with the facilities which are required in life.
Yeah.
So that is a responsibility. And this responsibility is for the sake of gaining.
This has not to be ignored.
This has not to be ignored. And through this he can achieve proximity to Allah Almighty. That is spirituality.
Yeah, we'll discuss more on this after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned with us.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, honor your children and teach them good manners.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I'm Zainab with Professor Nakavi, and we are saying that an adolescent who thinks his life is good for nothing and avoids gatherings, why he does so. Professor Nakavi, so far you discussed very beautiful concepts. You said that, first of all, it's in the fitra, it's in the inside of human being that he wants to attain perfection. He wants to go towards spirituality. But when he sees world around him just going after the material gains and going in one cycle, he gets bored. And it's something that's against his fitra. He sees things going opposed to what is inside him. He does not get answer to that exploration that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has kept within him. That's how he thinks basically life is good for nothing.
Yes, of course, and he needs, every human being needs love, needs care, needs respect. So if he's not getting that today in today's world, in this today's mechanical world, which everything, in everything, everyone is in so engaged in personal gains that we forget to engage with each other in the family, within relatives, within society. The human touch is becoming lesser and lesser every day. The human relationships, our engagement, as we mentioned, with nature. I mean, today, how much do we go out and explore nature? How much do we go out to enjoy and the nature that Allah Almighty has created? How many do we have our hobbies in the form of exploring nature, studying nature, going out to interact with nature, working in gardens, in places where we are working with animals or maybe plants and trees and so many things which are there. So this engagement, this interaction with nature, with other human beings, this is diminishing and decreasing day by day, especially before, because of our mechanical work that we have to do to make ends meet. And unfortunately, one of the pitfalls of a capitalist society, which is continuously looking for material gains, is that people become robots. As we mentioned once, triple M's. Money-making machines. So the human element is going out. So we need to come back to that, developing human relations, love, respect, interacting with each other, discussing ideas, thinking about each other, exchanging our thoughts and feelings with each other. That is unfortunately becoming very, very little today. So we need to come back to it. We need to sort ourselves. We need to plan our days in such a way that we, as the many ahadith have been mentioned, in which it has been emphasized that one part of your lives, daily lives, should be engaged with Allah Almighty in the form of prayers and so on. Then you have to keep one time for your livelihood and one time for your leisure and your engagement with other human beings and one time for your rest.
Yeah.
Resting. So, I mean, 3 to 4 types of, you know, times have to be made. And this is important for development of the human spiritual self.
All right. So we can help this adolescent by just changing our own timetable, by dividing our time, by giving time to work, but not all time to the material work, but to spirituality, to our leisure time, to rest, and divide our times into many other things and give a little change to our life so that a child does not feel like we are not exploring in this world, because we have been created to explore so that we reach perfection. So if he sees things going against that fitra, he will get confused, and we don't have to confuse him. It's our responsibility to show him the right path. Thank you so much, Professor Naqavi, for helping us with the beautiful answers. Thank you so much to your listeners. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. In case you have any questions, any feedback, please feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. You can also search us on the social media platforms by just searching Call of Islam Radio. We'll be there. And in case you want to listen to our program or our previous sessions as well, go back to our official website, which is www.parstoday.ir/encoicalofislamtab. Thank you so much for being with us. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space returned upon rest.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.